Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll talk about England and in particular Gareth Southgate. Has his mood changed this summer? Let us know what you think about that. We'll also be talking about Scotland and Wales. Lackluster performances for Scotland once again. Is Steve Clarke under pressure yet? We'll also talk about how Rob Page is getting the groove back with Wales at the moment. We'll be talking as well about gambling sponsorship on Premier League shirts. All that and more on this episode of The Game. Hello again, welcome to The Game. I'm Hugh Wisencroft alongside Tom Clark and Alison Rudd. We'll be looking back on a lot of international football, some club stories too, on this episode of The Game. We've got to start with England, as we have done throughout the Nations League. A 0-0 draw with Italy at Molineux on Saturday. How will we string together a long conversation about the events of the weekend? It was a much changed England side. They failed to win for the third time in a row. The last time that happened in competitive fixtures, 2006. 6-7 when they drew at home to North Macedonia, lost in Croatia and were held to a goalless draw in Israel. But it's also 4 hours or so without scoring from open play in these games for England. Of course, they host Hungary tomorrow. But it was it another lacklustre England performance? What do we think of it? What was at the heart of it? Alison, I'll start with you.
At the heart of it was, I don't think you can blame end of season fatigue and players thinking about the beach for an inability to score goals, because there was enough reasonable defending and reasonable imaginative midfield play and some good link-up play for the clue to be there that they decided, well, we're playing, let's try and have a bit of fun. So it's not that at all. It's probably that Italy have, throughout my entire life, been very good at defending, and they continue to be very good at defending in this particular game. And so these things happen, but of the Nations League games so far, I think this one had more interesting talking points, because Southgate is rotating like crazy and you can't draw any conclusions really about who he likes and doesn't like, except I suspect he's not going to give a starring role to James Ward-Prowse. But I really like his composure in an England shirt. I thought some of the more palatable, watchable moves were because of his vision. I really like Declan Rice's energy. You can see him as a future England captain giving blood and guts in a really key game at a major tournament and stirring, you know, the troops on and so on.
To a valiant defeat, yeah.
No, but I mean, you know, this is what...
It's what happens, isn't it?
It's what I want to see from England players, is that sense of something extra and different when they put on an England shirt, rather than looking slightly less than they normally do. Less in every sense: character, performance, energy, discipline, talent. The team's worth, what, over £1 billion, and yet, you know, they cannot find a way to exploit that fact. I think what's at the heart of it is that Gareth Southgate, of everyone involved, looks the most tired. That's the weird thing. He starts saying things like, I'm not going to outstay my welcome. He looks grumpy on the touchline. He's admitting he's picking players that aren't being picked to win the match. Well, what does that say to the players you have selected? I mean, that's probably at the heart of it, isn't it? A lot of those players don't think they're going to be crucial for their country. So it just seems counterproductive to, on the one hand, sound like you're being very sensible, because he's a very sensible man, Gareth Southgate, and he's trying to make sure there's no burnout and that you know, he tries to refresh the squad. But there's a way of doing that, and he didn't do it in the correct way because he made it sound like, oh, I've got a lot of B-listers out because I don't want to tire out my stars. That was what was at the heart of it.
Do you agree, Tom? I'm going to pick up on some of those points with Alison shortly because there were a few things there. You're right, some interesting things to discuss, but I just wanted your overarching view as to what you think the issue is.
Well, I think Alison hinted at it there. It was for me a more interesting and a slightly more improved performance than some of the ones we've seen of late, I think. And slim pickings, of course, in the recent fixtures and results, but I think Alisson's point about the goals as well is a good one. You know, you're playing Italy, and we've got to remember in some of these games where England have won in the past in bigger tournaments than the Nations League, they've kind of had the same number of clear-cut chances that they had in that game. Raheem Sterling scores at the back post rather than spooning it over the bar, and Tammy Abraham takes his chance after some good pressing work. And maybe you win the game 2-0, and then we're going, well, that was a good turnaround for beating Italy 2-0. Pretty impressive. But I think the point about Gareth Southgate is an interesting one as well. Owen Slot's written this morning a really interesting piece backing Southgate, and the intro goes, not much further to go now, with England limping wearily toward the close of this never-ending season. Saturday evening in Wolverhampton made their requirements very clear. Can we please find a nice quiet beach and send Gareth Southgate there for a rest? And I think when Southgate is acting as Alison pointed out, that kind of says a lot about the overall mood, well, I would say, around.
I don't get why he needs a rest.
You don't get why Gareth Southgate needs a rest?
No, why do international managers need rest?
It's because more a break from the thinking, surely, around football, as in the whole season, because he's never not working, is he? Let's be honest, give him his due. I don't think most international managers are working very hard. You know, he's never not going to games. He's never not speaking to players.
Yeah.
Which is the moment, and that's where you earn your money. I completely disagree with Slotty's intro there, because it looks like the best job in the universe. He just trucks up, usually with someone famous sat on his left or his right. And, I mean, they may or may not be interesting, but he's a guest of every club he goes to.
But he's not having the sandwiches.
He's not even making notes most of the time. He's not got his iPad out. He's sat there watching. Occasionally you get the odd, you know, raised eyebrow or smile, but not that often. Watching game after game after game. And if you love football, that is fantastic. And then he has these rare opportunities. They must be, you know, absolutely, he's supposed to absolutely love these moments when he can bring them all together and create magic.
I think
because he's been watching so much football. How can you possibly, at the moment where it's the only point at which he's in charge, as opposed to watching what other managers are doing, he has a chance to show, I'll beat my chest and I'll say fantastic things and I'll be inspirational. He shouldn't be tired. And if he is tired, he should stop.
I think that's absolutely true, apart from this particular international window.
No, I disagree. And I know the Euros was last year, so it's weird because it feels a bit like you've gone from tournament to summer tournament. Yeah. So maybe there's
summer tournament, get to a final, you know, the hangover from that, straight into a season and having to do your work. And I take your point that, yes, he does, you know, sit there, but he's not then popping into the box after for a bottle of champagne, is he? He will be doing work. Fine, he might not be sat there with his iPad all the time, but you're kind of talking there about, you know, visual PR that he should be doing.
So I'm saying, furiously making notes. I'm saying, rather than being tired by this point, this is the moment he should spark to life, because he knows everyone else who has been running around is tired.
Yeah, that's true. But I do think there's a different type of tiredness. It's a general kind of mental fatigue, maybe perhaps with this football this season. And I do think we're coming to I'm not going to jump in, Hugh, and talk about points that we're perhaps coming to, but Johnny Northcroft wrote in his excellent football newsletter last week about we're heading into this period of where you have the Champions League final nearly in June. Next year, I think we're going to have an FA Cup final in June for the first time in its history, or first time for many, many, many decades. And we're getting to this point now, and I do think that's a factor as well. It's not just the physical tiredness of the players. There's this fatigue in general. I mean, we're doing a podcast about football, and it's mid-June, and you know there's still lots of things to talk about. There are still fixtures happening. But I mean, I don't know about you guys, but my friends, of which I kind of judge the level of interest of football and how it's going, it's the first time maybe in a WhatsApp chat of about 8 or 10 people, no comment about the England game, this most recent one.
Yeah, like, same.
The first time ever.
He's paid a lot of money to make it interesting.
I'm not saying that's that makes I'm just saying that I'm making a more broader point about the general fatigue.
It's not necessarily fatigue, though, is it? Because there's a point that you can say this England team has lost the interest of a lot of people.
Yeah, that's you could make that counterpoint. Yeah.
There are a lot of football fans that sort of, you know, as we went into these Nations League games and we started the conversations up again about international football, had obviously hung their hat on Gareth Southgate in England. You know, people were talking about favourites for the World Cup.
Yeah, because we've been spoilt rotten. We've gone to a semi-final, a final, and now we're going into games against Italy and drawing 0-0, creating a few chances with a very tired team. And actually, is that terrible?
No, but there's a part of me. Listen, let's break it down to some of the things that Alison was mentioning there. But there is a part of me that wanted to talk about some of the players. Let's go to that first then, because James Ward-Prowse, who you mentioned, I thought he was all right, you know. I don't have strong feelings about him.
He's that sort of player. I mean, I think that is the problem with him. If there's a problem, it's about perception with him. He's very neat and tidy and looks like, Mr. Goody Two Shoes. And I think it's just easy to forget him. It's because he's so neat and tidy. But I think those are the players that are essential in a disparate, you know, when you're bringing together people from other clubs, he's just and his set piece abilities.
But I do think that's interesting that we're talking about James Ward-Prowse in this game where we're talking about excitement and maybe losing the fans, and you're talking about Southgate having some enthusiasm as well at this time of the season. And you think back to England breaks where it's not a qualifier. Yeah, fine, it's the Nations League. It's this kind of midpoint, isn't it, between a friendly and something really serious. You need a player that's not James Ward-Prowse. You need maybe, you know, Jude Bellingham, the next Jude Bellingham, so that we're all going, oh, God, this is exciting. Unfortunately for James Ward-Prowse, he's not that type of player. He can have the best game of his career, and he still won't be exciting enough for a June match against Italy to get everyone's blood going.
Unless he whips one in the top corner. But my point on James Ward-Prowse is, and listen, when I said, you know, it made me seem like I don't think he's a great player, I was very public about this. He should have definitely been in the squad for the Euros, and I would definitely have him in an England squad. I just think since then, Jude Bellingham has emerged more, developed more, and I think he's got that place as the sort of, what, now second or third choice as partner to Declan Rice. I mean, Declan Rice is Batman. Everyone's auditioning for Robin, aren't they? Let's be honest, in terms of that midfield position, because it's Calvin Phillips. You know, you pull the lever at Las Vegas and it goes to Jordan Henderson, then you pull the lever for another game and it might become James Ward-Prowse. There is no one yet who I think, even though Calvin Phillips was great during the Euros, because of the season that he's had, broken up by injury, I don't think he's got that place nailed down as a midfield partner for Declan Rice. So and this is the reason I wanted to talk about these players, because we can talk about lackluster performances and the idea that the season was really long, but for all of those players in the squad playing for their place, these games are hugely important. There's no point saying, you know, like Kevin De Bruyne did, oh, what's the point in the Nations League? Why are we even playing these games when now we've got three games left until the World Cup? If you're James Ward-Prowse, that might be your only opportunity to play out of your skin and get yourself on the plane, or at least get yourself involved in the upcoming matches before the World Cup, so you give yourself another opportunity. Same with Tammy Abraham. Fakayo Tomori started at centre-half. He's another one of those players. And if Gareth Southgate wanted to inject some urgency into the performances, and I know he made six changes, but all of those fringe players, all of those ones that you say, look, I want to see how they do, put them all in at the same time. Rather than saying, look, let's play two-thirds of a team that, you know, is established, we'll rest Harry Kane, we'll try Tammy Abraham up front. Listen, I know they might not have got loads of great chances. Obviously, not playing with a first-choice team, you know, if Raheem Sterling wasn't there, for example, would Tammy get the chances, or whoever it might be that's an established England player. But ultimately, I think those players should be lifting the level, of intensity massively if they desperately want to be at the World Cup. And I don't think fatigue comes into it, because if this was a tournament, all of those players would be running more, fighting more, shooting more, doing more, and fatigue wouldn't have come into their mind. So clearly, two words, Nations League rather than World Cup, have changed the way that they're performing.
You make a good point about, you know, Ward-Prowse, particularly with that position, talking about Rice being Batman and looking for Robin next to him. But when you really think about it, you know, you're talking about these players pushing for a place and, you know, getting their spot in the team. If we were going into a World Cup knockout game tomorrow, I don't know whether there are too many positions where we don't know who would play. I mean, maybe centre-half partner for John Stones if Harry Maguire's form keeps struggling. Yeah, central midfield partner for Declan Rice. because of the injuries to Henderson and Phillips. But I think generally, do we not basically know who we'd pick? So I think then for these other players, like James Ward-Prowse, you should be fighting for your place on the plane, was the other phrase that you used, but you're not really going to be going out there to say, I can get in the starting 11. I know maybe that's too negative, but I don't...
You have to send a message to the manager that there might be, even if it's 2 minutes in a final, the last 2 minutes, there might be a situation that he needs you. It might just be, you know, for James Ward-Prowse, against the weaker teams, you know, could I start him against Iran, or could he play the last half an hour against Iran?
This is really unfair.
You need to convince.
Are you saying that when players who are essentially fringe are not obviously first choice,
but I'm talking about fringe of the squad,
they have to go out. They have to go out wearing a silly hat and telling jokes to catch attention. You do what you do best, and I think what I was trying to look for positives from this rather dire game. One of the positives was that I think what Ward-Prowse does well is slots in and integrates and can see the runs of players he doesn't play with week in, week out. And he has that intuition and a sort of calmness, which is a very important thing to do. When we saw Scotland implode by being unable to be calm when it really mattered.
Yeah.
It matters to be a calm, sensible, grown-up footballer. And if Gareth Southgate... I'm sure he can see that, or he wouldn't have brought him in. But looking on, I think it's incorrect to say, oh, shouldn't someone like James Ward-Prowse be showing us more to prove his worth? I think he did prove his worth, because that's what he's good at.
Yeah,
it's the quiet stuff.
Yeah, because you mentioned the point about you've got 5 minutes to go and you need a goal. But there are also times when an England team, hopefully there'll be times like this where you're 2-0 up and you need to just go the foot on the ball. There ain't no one better than that, is there? And, you know, you've got 20 minutes to go, and actually you're going, actually we've got another big knockout game, let's get Declan Rice off, let's put James Ward-Prowse on. So I think Alisson's right that you have that other way around, and I just think there was a combination of some players who fitted that mould more, i.e. we're going to be playing for a squad place, and that also becomes a factor.
Okay, all right, I'll take it all on board.
More interesting is why, when you've England have reached the final of the most recent tournament, only got knocked out on penalties, is the mood swinging against Gareth Southgate?
Because we are spoilt rotten.
But it's not
absolutely,
it's not
spoilt.
Just us, the media, is it?
No,
it's,
I mean,
the
we
people.
I'm making us we the people. We the Game Podcast, we the people. There's a new slogan for next season.
Because it's interesting. I mean, there has been, for me, I've said it before, I think there's a slight change of tone. You know, in terms of the personality that you think Gareth Southgate has been showing, and you said it's his job at the end of the season to lift the players and maybe energise the situation. I do think he's reacting a lot to the public perception of him. I find, you know, I've been there as a... I've only filled in this season as an England correspondent, but I was there, you know, for a few months, the last couple of England camps. And he seems now to be responding to very... You know, it's almost like speaking to Boris Johnson at times. It was like...
Whoa.
Let me just...
Whoa.
Let me just explain what I mean.
Yeah,
all right,
please,
just,
please
okay,
do.
Fine. Any member of... Any Tory member of cabinet, if you like.
Okay.
In which...
You're still going to need to explain.
Yeah. In which the question is always refers to the things that we've done well before. The answer to the question, right? So every time you ask a question, doesn't matter what that question is, at some point during the answer, it will be mentioned that we've reached the final of a European Championship and that we've reached the semi-finals of a World Cup. But that was then. You see what I mean? So you get this, you know, we were great with the vaccine rollout, even though the question was about energy bills. Do you see what I'm saying?
I see slightly what you're saying in terms of PR.
Exactly. So there's this constant PR of, well, look what we've done. You know, we may be perceived as negative, but look what we've done. We got to the final. You know, it's never about the game itself that's just happened, or the day before or the night before. It's always about things that we've done. And I think that is strange, because actually Gareth Southgate has always been quite forthright and open and always said, this is how things are. Suddenly, it's how things were. That is a change for me.
That is a slight change. But he has also said recently in an interview talking about the Euros, we kind of planned, we'd set a target of getting to the final. Maybe if we'd set the target of winning it. You know, so I do think there's still that level of introspection there and analytical kind of management. You know, he might be kind of doing the PR a bit more in the press conferences, but I would suggest that behind the scenes with the players, the work is still going.
But I think that's why his mood has changed. because I think he now feels like there's a downer on him. I think he's feeling it more. And maybe he's started to read the papers more. Maybe
I think there's always been a downer on
maybe
him.
Maybe he's listening to the Game podcast more often. I don't know. But he's starting to feel like he knows people don't rate him that highly.
But I think there's always been a downer on him. You know, when you think about how he got the job,
but there's
and then
a
that continually, there's a constant level of surprise when we've done well in tournaments, and then it kind of everyone comes round to my view that he's, you know, one of the greatest England managers of the last 50 years. No, but I don't think he's ever been that highly
rated. No, but here's the thing: before he was trying to prove to people that he deserved respect. And I think he feels that he has done that.
Yeah.
So now he's reached a point where
so
it's
now
like,
he's miffed he's not getting it.
Exactly.
I think that's completely fair.
Yeah, but that for me has changed his character and personality somewhat. You know, it was before it was, well, wait and see. And now it's, wait a minute, where's, you know, we've delivered, haven't we? Why aren't you giving me compliments? Why aren't people saying I'm a good manager yet? Like, what more did you want me to do? Did I have to win the Euros? Did I have to win the World Cup? And I think that mood, like, we're seeing a different Gareth Southgate. I'm not saying it definitely has affected his players, but it hasn't felt like the Gareth Southgate that was punching the air in his waistcoat not too long ago. It's just not the same guy.
I think the job has changed, and I'm not sure he's the right person for the new job because in some ways, he created the job.
Sorry, we should have had a gasp there, shouldn't we?
He's created the job he's had because it was about repairing the relationship with the players and the media and the players and the supporters, and it was bringing through young players and making them mature and feeling part of a group. And he was somebody who was very good with players under 25 and giving players a chance. I mean, no England manager in the history of football has ever given so many people caps. And so it was this sense of being an infant school teacher who's then asked to go on to take maths A-level at a secondary school. And that's not what he is, I don't think, having to think about more people who've matured and don't need him anymore. And so that, you know, he's dealing with different problems to solve and players that don't need him to help them. They're fully formed and have big roles at big clubs. And I don't think he knows how to make that integrate to become something magical. The best England manager will be one who makes England play better than the sum of their parts, adds a bit of sparkle and has the personality to deal with the big characters and well-paid people that he's dealing with.
I think you're right. We could, I don't think it's out of this world to consider a scenario in which Southgate leaves after the World Cup and after a World Cup, which might end up being disappointing for lots of England fans. That could happen. But I do think that I disagree with you in the sense that analogy of the school teacher progression. I think he's shown as a manager, both on and off the pitch, a level of progression that means that, you know, going into the Euros, there were lots of question marks about, and they came back to Southgate and whether he's the right person for the job. And then he got us to a final. So I think he deserves the chance to show whether he can go again and improve and tweak and change again. But I do think that you raise an interesting point about the future of England in a grander sense.
I think he's going to come under pressure if he doesn't start, certainly scoring from open play. You know, as Alison said, you've got to be, I think, equal to the sum of your parts would do at the moment in terms of those attacking players, because it feels a waste. It feels a huge waste to have a squad like that, which is so top heavy. Yes, we all know it, but if you're going to be top heavy, then at least let that part of the team excel, even if you've got issues defensively. And at the moment, neither, I guess the defensive side is good, not great. We don't concede many goals, but then I think when you talk about the forward players, it's way off. It's way off. If he doesn't find a solution to that, not only will England not win the World Cup, he will get replaced. Next up from the Nations League, Scotland, who I think missed a golden opportunity to have a good start. It's officially, I think, a poor start to the Nations League. A poor result away from home. The Republic of Ireland beat them by 3-0 in Dublin. That left Scotland with 1 win and 1 loss from their opening 2 Group B1 matches. The Scots face Armenia away. That's tomorrow next. Ukraine will seek to maintain their 100% record against the Irish. Michael Grant from The Times joins us. He made the journey to Dublin to watch the game. What are your feelings after that, Michael? Where does this rank amongst recent Scotland performances?
Well, it's certainly by far the worst, Hughes, since Steve Clarke took over 3 years ago. I mean, sadly, with Scotland, you never have to go into the distant past to find an embarrassing or horrific performance. But I think this is certainly the worst since Kazakhstan, when Scotland lost 3-0 in the game that really did for Alex McLeish as manager. Now, you know, there has been some chatter about what Saturday in Dublin means for Steve Clarke. I don't think we're there yet in terms of serious discussion about the manager's future, but that could change quite quickly if Scotland slip up again against Armenia. But Armenia are a poor side. Scotland beat them quite comfortably at Hampden last week, but obviously Yerevan can be a difficult place to go to. It's Scotland fly out on Monday afternoon, 5.5-hour flight. It'll be hot over there. The team has got no confidence whatsoever after what happened in Dublin. So, you know, all of that could make it tricky, but they ought to win, and that will, you know, that will calm the mood around Scotland for a little while. But really bleak in the Aviva Stadium.
Tell us about the past two games, because I think there was a bit of a reaction from the, I guess, Scottish football public to the approach that Steve Clarke took when it came to that World Cup playoff game. In terms of the formation and approach in the past two matches, how would you rate what Steve Clarke has done?
Well, Steve Clarke sticks pretty firmly, or at least starts with a 3-4-2-1, which really was a system that he imposed on the team to find a way to get both Kieran Tierney and Andy Robertson in on the left side. And to be honest, it's been one of the big successes when they're both available. I think the two of them work well together. They play off each other. One will go up and the other will stay back. They have a good understanding. Now, the problem, of course, is that when Tierney is out injured, as he currently is, and he will miss all of the four games that Scotland are playing in June, that system is not so effective. You don't have somebody, you know, bursting forward from the back and taking the ball on. You don't have somebody combining with Robertson down the left. So that has been one of the criticisms of Clarke over the Ukraine game and now Ireland. But I must say, I think we can kind of we can over concentrate on whether it should be a back three or a back four. Really, the issue in Dublin was just poor individual defending and you know, not attacking crosses, not having the aggression and the kind of will to beat your man. And Shane Duffy, who, you know, was really kind of lampooned when he was in Scotland with Celtic, had a dreadful season with Celtic last season. But he was actually a real handful for the Scottish defence in when he was up for corners, and they got the first goal from it. So, I mean, that's been... Scotland's conceding far too many goals. They conceded 3 to Ukraine, another 3 to Ireland. And of course, they've also dried up in terms of scoring. 5 games this year, not a striker has scored for Scotland since last November.
Michael, can I ask what the mood is in the press box? I mean, you say you don't think it's quite the time for Steve Clarke's future to be assessed, but there comes a tipping point with every manager when there's a mini crisis. And the media that know him well and follow the team around go with them to a point, and then there's a U-turn. Do you feel that that's not close, or is there a lot of loyalty towards him? What's the mood?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Alison. There is always a tipping point. As I say, it was a Kazakhstan game for McLeish. I think it could be, potentially, if they were to lose in Armenia, it could be a tipping point, because I think the media guys, the press guys, have been pretty supportive of Clarke by and large. You know, there was a lot of goodwill for getting to Euro 2020, getting through a tough away playoff in Serbia on penalties. Okay, Scotland were pretty drab at the Euros themselves, but the country enjoyed being there. And we then had a good, strong qualifying campaign for the World Cup, which tends to get slightly overlooked, but they finished second behind Denmark. They were pot 3 seeds and finished second. Now, that's the first time since Euro 2008 that Scotland have finished higher than their seeding, got them a playoff place. I'm not sure that we really saw this June form coming, you know, this kind of collapse against Ukraine and then against Ireland. And although the Ukraine game was more significant, far more significant and painful in terms of the consequences. In some ways, the Ireland game is even more alarming because with the best of all in the world, it's not a great Irish team. You know, they were under pressure themselves. There was a lot of criticism of the standard of their squad, a lot of championship players, English championship players, and yet they were all over Scotland. They outplayed them in every department of the side. So that's concerning. And the piece I wrote for this morning's paper was basically concentrating on the number of times that Scotland just failed to show up. You know, it happened in the two home games at the Euros. It's now happened against Ukraine. It's now happened against Ireland. And a team that we think is pretty strong with big names in it just doesn't seem to show up too often.
Michael, you mentioned formations and kind of critiques over system and things like that. You've also mentioned Kieran Tierney being out injured. One of the things when international managers come under the spotlight is they're not picking the right players. There are other players in the missing from the squad. Is that the case with Clark as well, or is he kind of working with what he's got?
Yeah, I think how it works in management. When results are poor, you know, everything comes under the spotlight, and it's almost open season. I think by and large, people are generally happy with the team that he picks. I mean, we don't have a huge pool of players. I mean, there's quibbles. At the weekend, there was people saying, well, John Souter played well in midweek, the defender who's about to move from Hearts to Rangers, and he could have stayed in the back three. I suppose the biggest selection question is always whether Scott McTominay should be in midfield or defence. You know, Clark often plays him on the right side of a back three. Doesn't always work, but then, you know, at its best, Scotland's midfield is the strongest aspect of the team. But no, I mean I think there are quibbles about one or two selections, but by and large, I think most people would pick the 11 that he has put out, or you know, most of them. But it's just been the failure to get inspired and passionate and aggressive performances out of them with a bit of energy and tempo. And of course, you know, there's been questions about, are the players tired? Is it fatigue? Is that a trip too many? Or a kind of tour of duty too many? Now, you know, I've heard similar things about England, whose performances have been relatively flat this month too. But, you know, that's a concern for Scotland, because we all know that, you know, international football is now going to happen every June. Scotland have two European qualifying games next June. So, you know, we can't get into this mindset that the season finishes in May, because for Scotland and other national teams, it's going to keep going into June, and it's going to be a regular annual test.
Just before you leave us, Michael, deep down in your gut, if he doesn't beat Armenia, what happens?
I think the SFA will still be loyal to Clark. He's got a lot of support in there. I think they would try and ride out the storm, but I think he would lose a lot of supporters. I think he would lose some of the media for the first time, because really they ought to be beating Armenia, you know, with a bit to spare. I know, maybe that sounds misguidedly arrogant, but they should. I mean, you look at the two squads, there's no comparison. So I think if Armenia goes badly on top of Ukraine and on top of Ireland, Steve Clark's future becomes a discussion for the first time. I think the SFA would try and ride it out, but that's what we would be writing about for the next 3-4 days. Well, I would be, certainly.
Michael Grout, we look forward to it. We'll see if it's a victory, win, lose or draw, whatever it is for Scotland. We'll be reading your reaction in the Times. Thank you so much for joining us on the Game Podcast. Up next, I think Wales deserve a mention, don't they? They ran the Netherlands very close in midweek, although they were beaten in the end, then managed to grab a 1-1 draw with Belgium at the weekend thanks to Brennan Johnson's late equaliser. The draw is a first point in the top tier of the Nations League for Wales. They suffered defeats by Poland and the Netherlands previously. But as I say, this point against Belgium was a very good one. Gary Jacob watched the match. Of course he did, for the Times. Hi, Gary. What has the mood been like in this Wales camp? Because they seem to be a side that at least gives themselves a chance against most of their opposition. They're hanging in there most of the time. They did it at the weekend as well. And I think they're getting back to the Wales side that qualified for the Euros. I think that some of the performances and the way they exited the Euros with a big defeat to Denmark, I think that dampened the mood quite a lot. And we seem to be seeing this resurgent Wales, who are once again that side that looked like they could surprise us, just like in 2016. How do you see them?
Probably since the days of Coleman, they've been a side that have overachieved and managed to hang in games and get achieved results against better teams than they probably should have done on paper. Obviously, against Ukraine, they were totally outplayed and were very fortunate to come through that game. But if you look at the game against Belgium, they had some chances. Belgium had quite a few chances and probably slackened off at the end, really, and should have taken it to bed. But at the end of the day, Wales hung in there and they clung out a draw, and that could be quite a priceless draw for them if they actually want to try and stay in the higher level Nations League. Against Holland, they made a lot of changes, so it wasn't really a game you can kind of compare them to. But Paige said before the weekend that he felt that the game against Belgium was the first time he could actually pick a team with the World Cup in mind, partly because they just qualified, but also because I think he's thinking about, well, what am I going to do there, and who am I going to pick for a tournament situation? For example, on Saturday he put Ampadu into midfield because it was evident against Ukraine that they were struggling in the centre. Joe Allen's legs probably aren't quite what they were in the past, and Ampadu can add that extra little bit. Unfortunately, Allen had a hamstring injury and he went off, so that was one change. And I think that The interesting question is whether he finds a way to get Brennan Johnson into the team. It's hard to see how he would do that unless he drops Dan James, which is perhaps not beyond the realms of possibility, because James, for all his running, doesn't have much of a final delivery or a final shot, and that side of his game is still needs to be worked on. And maybe Johnson will become a bit of a kind of wild card in Qatar, or maybe who continues to use him as an impact substitute as he's done recently.
On Rob Page, let's go back to him very, very quickly. Has he changed the mood? Has he managed to re-galvanise his players, if you like, after the disappointment of the Euros? Because I feel like maybe it's qualifying for the World Cup, but they're building a wave as we head towards Qatar. They seem to be getting stronger. The unity is there once again. The smiles are back.
Yeah, I think at the Euros, it was a tricky situation, and they probably realistically only probably played well in one of the three of the four games they played, beating Turkey. In the other games, they weren't that well, and Denmark were just a much better team and totally outclassed them. I think now, a year on, people like Nico Williams have had another year under their belt. Harry Wilson has another bad year. They've got players. Ampadu's has another year of football. The squad have got more experience with them in them. Bale obviously hasn't had as much football this year, nor as Ramsey. And I think they've kind of, Bell made the point, they've started to kind of gel a lot more. And probably that was one of the things over the recent years, because some of the senior players in 2016 had retired and the younger ones coming through were very inexperienced. And probably now they're just a much more, there's more unity within the kind of group. And so I think going to the tournament, it's not going to be easy for them. United States is on a pushover, and obviously they've got England and Iran, so it's not going to be easy for them, but they've got a way of playing and it works for them, and so that they won't be easy to beat.
Gary, if Rob Page went out for a beer with you and he was being completely honest, where would he want Gareth Bale to sign for? What would be the perfect build-up for Gareth Bale looking at November?
That's a very good question. I would kind of probably say somewhere near Cardiff. If it's not Cardiff, it has to be somewhere near Cardiff, because he can go home to his parents, he can go home to his own house, he can play golf in South Wales, and also he can use the physios that are down there, which is going to be important. And Bell made the point this morning in the press conference that he didn't feel like he was match fit coming into these internationals, because he hadn't played much over the season, but he felt like he could could have played more, and effectively the club weren't playing him, and he had more fitness than people believe that he has. So I think, and he also made the point that it doesn't matter which level he plays at, which standard, because a game is a game, which I think opens the door to Cardiff and move there. I think if he's just doing it, if Rob Page is asked, he would probably say, as long as the most important thing is for Gareth to be happy, and probably most people assume where Gareth would be happy will be close to his parents in South Wales, and there it's really hard to see him far away and then doing the kind of commute again. It's a good question. What would you say, Alison?
Well, no, it's interesting that you seem to think the priority for the Wales management is his mentality and his happiness.
But he's been
unhappy at Real Madrid and yet able to park it and do the business for Wales. I mean, I think that's probably one of the most remarkable things about Gareth Bale, really. All that negativity he's had around his not being picked for Real, and yet when he's trucked up for Wales, he's not looked like he's got a care in the world. So I think he could probably play anywhere in England, couldn't he?
I think he dumped the negativity at the door when he arrives at the Wales camp. He sort of becomes a different person after about the first day. But I think he's also made the point that he needs to play games. So I think that really does reduce the options. Is he going to get a Premier League team that's going to give him enough games? And the other thing you've in the back of the mind that people are always going to think about was, come September, is he going to be trying in quite the same way as he would be at the start of the season, with the back of his mind thinking, I don't want to get injured for the final. So that's going to have a bearing on what club maybe are willing to take him, or what manager, and he's going to want to call a lot of his shots about how he trains, when he trains. I mean, for example, he has a special training regime, and it's all fit around him at Wales. He decides when they travel, how they travel, what they travel in. And so he's going to want something that kind of ticks a lot of his boxes, which, well, I don't know whether a Premier League team will give him that type of luxury. I think people did wonder whether he would go to the MLS and then go and take up some sort of golf, but he hasn't really bitten on that, and he doesn't give much away when you ask him about his future. He's just said today that he will talk to his family and talk to the physios and see what is best. I think the physios are going to be key for him. Where can he do the work with the physios that he needs to do to prevent muscular injuries that have kind of blighted him and ensure he stays fit? I mean, he was asked on Saturday, what type of contract would you want? And he suggested, maybe 1 or 2 years. And then people sort of slightly laughed and they said, well, the assumption is that you will retire after the World Cup. And he didn't really bite on that. But I think that's kind of what most people will think, that whatever contract he takes with a club come January, he will say thanks very much. And that will be him done.
Yeah, but you don't know the impact of the pressure of that. If the world knows you're going to retire after the World Cup, that makes the World Cup a different tournament than it would for most of the people competing, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's hard to see him to go on much beyond that, really. Certainly for Wales, it's hard to see if he's going to kind of hit the next Euros, and whether he sees out the season at a club is debatable, really. I think maybe his time at Madrid is kind of not soured him, and he said today that he felt that what he's achieved in his career, if you're giving him what 10% of what he's achieved in his career, he would have been happy. But you wonder whether the last couple of years have sort of soured his feeling about football, and because of the way he felt he was treated at Madrid.
It is wonderful the way that he's this sort of megastar, and yet he's so, you know, the way he hugs Sorba Thomas when they beat Ukraine. It's like, he's just one of the lads. There's no sense of slightly better than the rest of you about him at all.
No, I think there never has been with him from sort of day one, really, with Wales. He's always, he loves the country. He loves the younger players coming through. I think there have been a couple of times when you thought he probably deep down thought the younger players coming through weren't quite what they had in the past, and so perhaps like the Euros, they weren't going to achieve what they could have achieved, what they achieved at 16. But a year on, with the players who are a lot more experienced, you feel like they're more of a competitive team now. But it was noticeable when they've had some videos of the camp, and you see where the players sit. It is Bale, Ramsey, Gunter, Hennessy on one table, then the younger players on another table. So although they are all unified, you can see it's all done by age, and he is one of the lads, but there is a kind of slight pecking order within there.
Do you sit with the whales online, guys, when you have a cup of tea then, Gary, or do you only sit with the broadsheets?
Always, Alison, you know me.
very well handled, Gary, very well handled.
Everyone's the same to me, Alison.
Gary Jacob, thank you very much for joining us on the Game podcast. We'll be reacting, I think, to Wales, who go to the Netherlands tomorrow, or today if you're listening on Tuesday. Big game for Rob Page's side. They did well against them last time. Would be incredible if they could go and win in the Netherlands. Gary, thank you very much.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Now, it's not often we speak about sponsorship deals on the Game podcast. This is not the business pages of the Times taking over the Game podcast by any stretch of the imagination. But it was an interesting thing. Lots of people reacted to on social media this week. Everton Football Club confirming a club record main partner agreement with Stake.com, which is, they say, a leading casino and sports betting platform. I think they stress in their second paragraph that it is the highest value front of shirt deal in the club's 144-year history. That is me quoting from their press release. And I think one of the things that was interesting to me was that there was a lot of criticism, in particular to Denise Barrett-Baxendale, who said after a previous sporting gambling company sponsorship deal had come to an end, that in an ideal world, Everton wouldn't have a gambling sponsor. And I thought, well, you know, when people were criticising Everton, I thought, well, this clearly is not an ideal world for Everton at the moment. They need as much money as possible. This is not even taking into account any feelings around whether there should be gambling companies involved with sport or football. It was just me simply saying that in the position they're in at this point in time, the highest value commercial deals they can do, they basically need to do. They're in a bit of a financial hole, Everton. So I could understand the criticism on moral grounds, but also in terms of the decision that the club made on business grounds, I could also completely understand it. But Alison Rudd, you wrote a piece about this in the Times. Why did you feel so strongly about it that you thought, I need to write a piece on this?
Because on every level, it makes no sense at all. You've just raised a couple of them. Political and common sense level, a government white paper is about to be released. It's imminent, probably within the next 10 days stating that gambling on the front of Premier League clubs' shirts will be prohibited. But why on earth would you, why on earth would you sign a deal for a piece of business that's going to be, you know, to all intents and purposes, illegal? That makes no sense at all. Makes you think, what, were they negotiating this deal when they thought they were going to be relegated to the Championship? Because you are allowed to wear gambling sponsors on Championship and below on the front of your shirts. Or have they devised some clever loophole where the way they do the break clauses for clubs that have already bought into contracts with betting companies, they get a sort of free hit at this for a few months or something? But it's not the future. I mean, this has not been a secret that the government were going to go down this path. The only reason there's been a bit of a delay on it is whether it was going to be a voluntary agreement made by the Premier League clubs or it was going to be imposed by the government. But either way, it's not going to be allowed. We're not going to have gambling companies on the front of Premier League shirts. So timing-wise, this is highly peculiar and speaks of either skullduggery or stupidity or something. It doesn't make any sense at all. And you say, Hugh, you know, these are tough times. Everton have had a loss of sponsorship as an indirect result of the ban on Russian business deals because of the invasion of Ukraine. But it's not that the clubs will never tell you exactly what their deals are worth, but this is about £13 or so million a year. And their deal with Kazoo was roughly £10 million a year. But you also make more on a deal that's slightly more ethical, if you like, because you're allowed to put that on junior kits. So you actually make quite a lot of money selling kits to kids because kids don't want shirts that don't look like the grown-up shirts or their hero shirts. So you can factor that in, and if you market it properly, you can make quite a lot of dosh. We're not talking huge gulfs of income difference here. And then you've got how it looks. I mean, Everton got a lot of praise for dumping a gambling sponsor and trying to find another route, because it was raised at their AGM a few years back. Everton are really big on, I know all clubs have their charity arms, but Everton are particularly big on mental health. They have a drop-in clinic, which is a fantastic idea. You know, if you're struggling, you don't know where to go, or you feel uncomfortable asking people, you can go in, you know, complete privacy to fully qualified staff to talk about mental health issues. And so it was raised, you know, a lot of those issues will be people either embarrassed by or struggling with gambling addiction. How can you offer this as a service to your community while at the same time promoting gambling to... Because when you promote gambling on the front of a shirt, you're promoting it to everybody, aren't you? Young children, the vulnerable, the impressionable, people who are struggling to avoid it in the first place. So how can you do that? And Denise Barrett Baxendale, she admitted that didn't sit well, and in an ideal world, she'd rather that they didn't do that. So that's the whole backdrop to this. So the last thing you would expect is for Everton to come up with a deal with a betting company. Mm. It makes zero sense on any level. I mean, even the financial level doesn't really make sense, as I've pointed out.
Mm. I can still see why they've done it. If that's the most money on the table, I can see why they've just gone, look, we need to take the money. I'm just saying that.
But they're not going to be allowed to take the money.
Well, there isn't. Listen, there's the argument there that will be put forward by the Premier League clubs, that there needs to be shown a causal link between the sponsorship.
We're beyond that, Hugh. The white paper's about to be released. It's not going to be the future.
But it will be voted on, won't it?
And sponsorship.
Will it be voted on?
It's one of those cross-party things that everyone's going to behind.
It's not going to be... Okay, that's what I was wondering, whether there was any chance of it not going through. Okay, all right. So it's going to happen. So I imagine there's a break clause in there that says, you know, we might get 5 million up front, and then, it's become illegal. We're going to have to drop it. And there will be something done with the company in question to, I think, maybe... what's the word? I think appease them. They might be in-stadium betting. They might continue to do that, because a lot of companies have had that, haven't they? They sign up with a betting partner and people can bet inside the ground on the match, can't they? They can still do that. So maybe there's a bigger element to this sponsorship deal than just the front of the shirts. It might stay on.
Yeah, but they're not. That's not going to be a problem. I think almost, I can't think of a club that doesn't have some sort of relationship with a betting company. But this is all about the impact of front of shirt sponsorship. This is the point. Even when Everton dumped their old betting partner, they still did other projects with them.
Mm. I think it's an interesting one, generally speaking, because of the amount of advertising that we see for gambling around football in general. Will there still be advertising in stadiums for gambling?
Absolutely, there will. This is a very specific thing. It's still seen as something that allows smaller clubs to exist. It's a really important revenue stream. And I think the interesting part of this white paper legislation is that, yes, they're saying, yes, you can play if you're playing in the Championship, which is still high profile, but he's not on telly as often. You can wear whoever you want on the front of your shirt, but it's very specific to the Premier League. They just feel the Premier League is so sexy, so influential, that they just don't want, and it's everywhere, that they just feel that it's seditious almost. It reaches beyond levels that they want it to reach, that it's getting to young people and forging this sense that gambling's fine. It's the way you should go because of the status of the Premier League. This is specifically a Premier League thing. And Everton, they may have forgotten, but they stayed up. They're still a Premier League club.
What do you think about it all, Tom?
Well, I think one of the things we're coming to is the idea of a shirt sponsor being the kind of the prime real estate, if you like, of the sponsorship.
Well, it is,
and you're right, and I think it is, because Alison talked about it there with the kids' kits and things. And if you think about a lot of these companies that in recent years have sponsored Premier League teams, a lot of them, I can remember, you get the press releases in your inbox and then you're going, Who's this company? Yeah. What? I've never even heard of them. They're not the kind of mainstream betting companies that...
There's a lot of global betting companies that want to sponsor football shirts.
Exactly. But that's then the point where if you're then talking about the kind of responsibilities of these teams, where kind of gambling as an addiction can become a major problem, if you're then promoting these companies that people haven't heard of before, some things that gambling companies do is that they can... preventative measures for locking people out of accounts and not allowing them to sign up. You're then promoting companies that people have never heard of, but then they go, have a £10 free bet on us type thing. That's where it does become really problematic. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about the rise of betting sponsorship on shirts is that a lot of those sponsors are companies that I'd never heard of before and that are now household names. And they are household names because they've been on the front of a Premier League shirt. And that applies not just to me, that applies to lots and lots of people in this country, young and old. And so I do think there's merit in the idea of banning them from Premier League shirts. I think Alison makes an interesting point about, the blurred lines between the Championship and things like that, because you could still argue, okay, well, if two teams get to the Championship playoff final and they're both sponsored by betting companies, that game's one of the most watched games of the season, et cetera, et cetera. So, but I think it's a positive thing if it were to happen, as it seems it will. I think Alison's point about Everton is more about the PR of it all and the fact that they said one thing and have now done something else. And that is really harmful in a broad sense because, as Alison said, they got a lot of praise at the time for ditching the previous sponsor and that's all been undone now.
Would you ban gambling advertising from sport in the UK, personally?
I think you'd then get into a very tricky problem. It particularly is working for broadcasters and the media as well, because let's be honest, a lot of the advertising that, we're a sports newspaper and a sports section. Quite often when you're in the past, when I've been doing, newspaper pullouts and digital publishing, talking about sponsors coming in, Cheltenham Festival, all that kind of stuff, all the sponsorship, the advertising is often through betting companies. Obviously, horse racing is intrinsically linked, but I think there are two different aspects here where the shirt sponsor, because it is that prime real estate, you can make the case that that would actually make a difference, and then you could still make the case that you're allowed the revenue that is so important to other clubs are hoarding around the side of a ground in contrast to a football shirt. I think if you had some of these companies that, as I said, I'd never heard of before they were on the front of a football shirt, I think if they'd been on hoardings around grounds, despite all the football that I watch, I think some of them would have just blurred into the background and I wouldn't have paid any attention.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different effect. It has different effects on different people, particularly if you had a gambling addiction, though. You know, if you see any kind of advertising for it, you, I'm sure, going to have a different reaction to someone that hasn't had that addiction previously. It's an interesting one for me because we've got stadiums named after companies, don't we? We've got the Etihad, we've got Emirates Stadium. We have big companies that have invested loads of money in football, and we've had moral arguments about football and where we draw the line in terms of morality. And I do think this is about a moral argument because, of course, we've seen other things banned from sport, you know, previously. Alcohol advertising, haven't we? We've seen smoking banned from different sports as well. Now gambling's on a similar list. And it's whether you know, where do we go in terms of what should be banned from being put on the front of a football shirt? You know, if there was an oil company with immoral practices who sponsored a football team, would we say, look, you know, bad practices at this company, they shouldn't be sponsoring football teams either, despite the fact they're in a different industry. Maybe we've already banned oil companies. You don't see many oil companies, all right, as a bad example, but, you know, there are different practices in different industries. And if it were to come out that a company had what we defined as immoral practice, would we want them to have sponsorship removed from a football club?
No, this is about normalising something that you shouldn't be exposed to when you're young. I think that's the point. It's just
so it's about young people.
It is because the law already says you can't put a gambling company on the front of a junior shirt.
Yeah.
So there's clearly they've decided and everyone's agreed to that. No one's said, oh, but don't agree with that. Everyone agrees that you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't have a 5-year old running around with a betting company blazoned on his chest. So but they still want, that's still what the child wants. They want the replica kit. Mm. They have their heroes wearing gambling sponsorship. So it's just about following through that line of reasoning, really. That it's
sleeves?
Just, it's just too seductive.
What about sleeves? Could we have a gambling sponsor on the sleeves?
That might be one of the small details that gets through the white paper. I don't know. We haven't seen it yet. It's just about that emblazoning of selling your soul to the gambling company, I think, regardless of the consequences. Does anyone know the first football club that had a sponsor on its shirt of any sort?
That had a sponsor of any description. Was it in the eight? Was it early 80s? No, it was late 70s, was it?
I think it was late 70s, yeah.
West Bromwich Albion?
Nope.
Leeds?
Nope.
No idea.
Kettering?
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
That's good.
Good quiz. Good quiz question.
Any more questions?
What was it advertising?
Do you know, in the upcoming podcast, the Big Fat Quiz of the Year, you know, we just turn that into a football-related one between us on the podcast. It might make a good episode in the coming weeks.
I mean, coming weeks, we've got Thursday's show and then we're taking a break before the Women's Euros. So.
All right, so you want to do it on Thursday?
Thursday, we're doing a Big Fat Quiz of the Year. Okay, fine, great.
I will see you then. You've signed up to it, Tom Clark. We'll get you on the phone. Alison Rudd, we'll see you very soon as well. Thank you both for being with me. There's no conclusion, by the way, to that conversation at the end. I just wanted to explore the themes. And I was, of course, trying my absolute best to fight one side of the argument that I, you know, has very little ground to stand on. But there you go. So just so you all know before you tweet me, you know, just trying to balance things out as we do every episode of the Game Podcast. And we'll be reacting to these midweek games. Finally, the Nations League comes to an end. There are going to be some big signings to talk about on Thursday as well. But remember, if you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy the Times and the Sunday Times, make sure you are subscribed. Sign up at thetimes.co.uk/thegame, and we'll see you soon.